Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It used to be that when reporters covered wars, they went to the wars. The war on terror, however, the Pentagon has largely kept journalists away from the action. In his first news conference after the September 11 attacks, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld ended by warning that anyone in the Pentagon caught leaking unclassified material would be prosecuted. Mark Thompson is defense correspondent for Time magazine. I asked him if officials in the Pentagon have been heeding Rumsfeld's warning.
Yeah, the Secretary, Jack, has made it clear right from the get-go that, providing information that should not be released in any way, shape, or form could be helpful to the enemy, and that means bad to the U.S. military, so you better not release it. Plainly, some folks have taken this to heart a little, perhaps too literally. The Deputy Secretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz, has gone so far as to say, hey, folks, don't even release anything that's unclassified. You know, you're better off just keeping your mouth shut. And that's really clamped down on what reporters are able to glean from their usual Pentagon sources.
Were you shocked in the room when he said that? When he ended that press conference on that note?
Yeah, I mean, plainly, defense secretaries, and I've covered six or seven of them, always or frequently bow in that direction. Mm-hmm. But Secretary Rumsfeld has been rather stern about it. He's made it clear. He has said it repeatedly. And you can just tell by his demeanor that if he finds a case that he thinks worth prosecuting, he's going to recommend it be prosecuted. No one else has ever had that sort of attitude about it.
Now, you've been quoted as saying, we are the auditors of this operation that is the press, and sometimes you get the feeling there's a little too much Arthur Anderson going on. What do you mean by that provocative statement?
Well, with no offense due Arthur Anderson, a lot of this war, in fact, if you pay attention to previous conflicts, the Gulf War, Kosovo, even going back to Vietnam, I mean, in Vietnam we had the 5 o'clock follies in Saigon, where the people came out and said what was going on, even as correspondents were going out into the field and seeing that really wasn't what was going on. Here we've got a war largely explained to the American people from the Pentagon podium. And we don't have much on-the-ground reality checking going on, at least for the first 3 months of the conflict. In the last several weeks, more and more correspondents are getting into Afghanistan and are, you know, investigating things that the Pentagon did months ago and finding out that, well, you know, they weren't exactly as crystal clear as portrayed from that Pentagon podium, be it a raid in October, an attack on a convoy in December, the January 24th raid on the village north of Kandahar, or the February 4th predator attack on a tall man surrounded by a couple of other guys. So it's now that the press is getting out there, I think we're getting a better picture of what's going on.
I've been surprised there hasn't been more on the Tora Bora story. That is, you've seen hints about this, but the charge, I think, perhaps from within the military or from other military sources in other countries, that because we didn't put our own forces on the ground in Tora Bora to conduct the search for bin Laden and the al-Qaeda leadership, assuming they were there, got away, and that this was a sort of the secretary, for one reason or other, didn't want to pull the trigger, putting American forces in there, and he left it up to locals, and they botched it. What about that story?
Well, the truth of the matter, Jack, is that everything here is a balancing act. And if we had sent in 100 or 200,000 American troops to try to pin down bin Laden, you know, there's still a good chance we would not have gotten him. That territory is so rugged. The borders are so porous. The weather now is so bad. But as you may recall, back around the holidays, one day the story was he's into Pakistan. The next day was, well, we've heard him on a short-range radio in the Tora Bora region, so we know he's within a mile of where these Afghan folks who are looking for him are now, you know, shooting away at the mountains. There was a lot of white noise up there, a lot of confusion. And plainly, one way that America could have boosted its chances of grabbing Bin Laden was to have put a lot more American forces in there. But I'd be leery of suggesting it would in any way guarantee it.
Sure.
And I think the military is smart enough to know, at least in this case, that, you know, the more folks you put in there, the more are going to die. And maybe you don't want to invest too much. After all, the U.S. military did put a reward of up to $25 million on Bin Laden's head. If that wouldn't entice some Afghans to go and get him, I don't know what would, because the Americans just don't know the terrain there. It'd be a very difficult challenge for them to do any better than the Afghans did, I think.
Now, you have to ask Don Rumsfeld questions. Tell us what's that, what that's like, and maybe you could even recapitulate one of your exchanges with him.
My colleagues and I, it's become sort of funny, because with previous defense secretaries, it's almost like they're at batting practice when they take questions, and whether you lob them a softball or throw something in high and inside, you know, the guy will step back and give it a mighty swing and try to knock it out of the park. Rumsfeld doesn't do it on automatic pilot like that. To his credit, if it's a stupid question, he will tell the reporter it's a stupid question. I asked him once about the dispatching of troops to the Philippines, and I asked him whether or not there was a higher standard for U.S. troop presence going into the Philippines, because the bad guys there were holding a couple of Americans hostage. And he just stopped and he said, well, what do you mean by a higher standard? And reporters, while they are used to asking questions, are not too used to getting them shot back at their face, especially, you know, in these high-profile situations. I mean, so number one, it shows you that the guy is listening. Mm-hmm. He's not like the Dow, you pull the string and he has 11 different phrases like previous defense secretaries that I've covered. Mm-hmm. You know, Rumsfeld takes the question. He may be dismissive of it. Mm-hmm. He may ridicule the reporter for asking it. But I think it shows basically a nimble and an agile mind getting his hands around the question, saying, this is a stupid question. I don't have to answer it. I know the American public is with me on my answer here, so I'll just sort of give the boilerplate. Or on some of the questions that are more provocative or thought-provoking, you know, as was the discussion last week when reporters were asking about the division of labor between the CIA
yes.
and the Pentagon. I mean, he, you know, he said, let me talk about this a bit, and he sort of did, you know, expand and expound on the sort of essential weirdness of having these two agents of national power working side by side in a single theater of war. And that, you know, for historians and for journalists, that's a motherlode of information.
Yeah, this is with reference to the civilian deaths of the tall, slim man
right.
scene and
right.
a Predator plane run by the CIA bombed it. Yeah,
the alleged civilian.
The alleged, yeah, right, right,
okay.
right. Before September 11th, Rumsfeld was not popular within that building because of his reform program. Has that all shifted now?
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's been a punt. I mean, he was a lousy Secretary of Defense, military officers will tell you, and a great Secretary of War. Let's face it, one is a manager and one is a leader. Mm. And the same brain, the same body, the same person rarely occupies both spheres equally well. I mean, old-timers will recall a decade or more ago when Dick Cheney, then the Secretary of Defense, was running something called the Defense Management Review, and everybody was laughing at how ham-fisted it was and how goofy it was and how it really wasn't going to work. And then August 2nd, 1990 happened, and Iraq invaded Kuwait, and nobody cared about that anymore. Mm. And all of a sudden, when you think back now to Vice President Cheney being Secretary of Defense, all you recall are him and Colin Powell, you know,
right.
going around the world, leading this war and doing it rather successfully.
Mark Thompson is defense correspondent for Time magazine. Immediately after September 11th, reporters substantiated their stories and gave a straightforward account of events. Public esteem for the press rose for the first time in 15 years. But the upswing quickly subsided, and according to the Pew Research Center, public approval fell from 56% in September to 30% in November. Our guest tonight, media analyst Tom Rosenstiel, says that this may be because journalists basking in their rare sweep of approval have gotten sloppy. Levels of factuality are lower now than those seen at the height of the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal, or the depth. Are you liking what you watch and read of this war more now than you did in September, or less? What grade would you give the media? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now is Tom Rosensteel, director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. He is the co-author of The Elements of Journalism, What News People Should Know and the Public Should Expect. With me here in the studio is our guest news analyst, Juliet Kayham. She is executive director of the executive session on domestic preparedness at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Welcome to you both.
Good evening, actually.
Good to be here.
Well, glad to have you, Tom. Let's begin with you. I just want to specify you studied. Just give us the itinerary of your study.
Well, we studied a wide swath of media over three different periods. We took snapshots of three different periods, one in mid-September, one in mid-November, and one in mid-December. And we were looking at a fairly wide swath of media that included the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, the Fresno Bee, which is a small paper in California, the four traditional nightly broadcasts of ABC, CBS, NBC, and PBS. We looked at all the relevant Dateline or primetime magazine programs, the morning news shows like Good Morning America and Today. We looked at the signature newscasts of Fox and CNN, which is Britt Hume's program and Aaron Brown's, and then four talk shows, Larry King, Charlie Rose, Chris Matthews, Hardball, and actually I'm blanking on the fourth one, and the Sunday talk show. So a fairly representative sample of what it is that you would get if you were watching television or newspapers.
Right. And what was to you the surprise, the counterintuitive finding?
Well, I don't know that anything was necessarily counterintuitive. What we saw was that the reporting was extraordinarily factual in September. 75% of all paragraphs of every story were a straight accounting of the facts. That number dropped to just a little bit over half. 63% of all the reportage was straight ahead. Here's what happened in November and December. And what replaced it was analysis, which we describe as reporting that is interpretive, but can cite some reporting as the basis for the interpretation, or it was punditry, which is straight opinion and speculation that is attributed to nothing other than the opinion of the speaker.
Mm. Now, the public had the preference for the first, straightforward reporting.
Yeah, and we know this from a variety of research. In the surveys that were done in the course of the war, when people were asked to volunteer in response to open-ended questions, what was it they liked, they actually volunteered. They liked that it was the informativeness, the factualness of the reporting.
Yeah.
We also know this from years and years of other research that's been done, that people say, and apparently it's backed up, or apparently they mean it, that they like the news to be unfiltered, that they like
just the
reporters
facts
to provide them with facts and stay out of the way.
Yeah. Judah Kayham, what's your bottom line? Stand and deliver here in the soundbite. How would you score the coverage of the war in 30 seconds?
I think in the first weeks, I guess I would agree with the Pew report that the media did what I think it does best, and each aspect of the media, from radio, TV, and then the magazines or newspapers, were all filling an important niche, depending on what it would be. But from the perspective of someone who gets called on this stuff, because I know something about terrorism, I also saw this sort of decline over time. The first couple days and weeks were, you know, what happened? Who's Al-Qaeda? What did we know? When did we know it? What does the U.S. government do now? These sort of historical questions of where we are now. I don't know exactly when it happened, sort of a complete push towards the yes or no, for or against, the sort of debate, you know. And, for example, with the John Walker Lynn case, the American Taliban, death penalty or not, those were the options that you were given. And it's
the
a lot more
Neronian option.
Right, exactly. You know, thumbs up, thumbs down. It's a lot more complicated than that. And you've sort of seen that, at least in the TV coverage, I think, over time.
Which certainly tracks the study's findings as well. We're scoring the media's coverage of the war this hour on point. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll be right back.
Boston University.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're grading the media's coverage of the war this hour. We want your opinion. We're talking to Tom Rosenstiel. He's director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism at Columbia, and with Julia Kayyem, executive director of the Domestic Preparedness of the Domestic Preparedness at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Have I got that right?
Yes, you're fine.
Thank you very much. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Tom Rosenstiel, the public wants the facts, but do they want stenography? I mean, in other words, do they just want to know what happened today? Is that their notion of what the press should do? Simply say, the Pentagon said today, and leave it at that?
No, but I think there's a lot of room between Hardball and Crossfire on mm-hmm. one end, and John Walker Lynn, freedom or death penalty,
right.
or what you would call, you know, just the facts on the other. I think people, and you know, I think that, you know, that when we say people want, there's a lot of people out there. There's a lot of audiences for news. There isn't one audience, but I think what on balance, more people than not say they prefer is information that they can use to help them make up their own minds. Now, that means providing context, putting these, and selecting the facts in an efficient way. There's a lot of research also out there that also suggests that while we've had a vast proliferation in the amount of news available to us, people don't spend fundamentally a lot more time with the news than they did even 100 years ago. It's about a half an hour on average. Mm-hmm. A lot of people less, some people more, but, you know, we don't have an infinite amount of time. We're plumbers, we're doctors, we're lawyers, we're, you know, school teachers, we're car mechanics. We have lives to lead, and we don't actually sit there watching C-SPAN all day long. So we want the press to select for us, and we want the press to put things in context and not waste our time. And one thing that actually wastes our time is food fights over what's going to happen next.
Yes.
Where afterwards we don't actually know what happened.
And that's what you see on the talk shows in particular.
Now, why is it that we get a lot of these talk shows then, if they're not particularly popular?
Yeah, well, tell us about the economics of punditry.
There's a couple of reasons. One is, talk shows are much cheaper to produce than producing news. It's a lot cheaper to have a host who books a bunch of guests for free, and I'm not getting paid here. than it is to have a network of bureaus and correspondents around the world to fill up a newscast. The second reason is that the economic model of cable news is quite different than broadcast news. Cable news is paid fees by the cable companies to the producers, to CNN and Fox, in addition to the advertising. So they're paid two ways. Broadcast news is delivered free to the audience, and all the revenue has to come from advertising. As a consequence, the CBS Evening News needs a much bigger audience to make money. A talk show on cable can make a lot of money with the same ratings that would have it canceled after a week on broadcast television.
Because of the different economics between cable and broadcast.
Because there's two different revenue sources that are substantial.
Yeah. Let's take a call. ML is on the line. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you. Well, I'm calling because as a European living in the States, I do check the European press, and now, especially with the Internet, it's possible to watch the news on European TVs. And the facts are quite different from the facts presented by the American media, which makes me feel like the facts given here are facts that are okayed by the White House. And I think that people should look at different sources. WBUR has been okay, better recently than it was in the beginning. But, like, tonight to hear this report that apparently the facts were given, well, that's good, but let's talk about what the facts are.
Can you give us an example, ML, of the different facts reported
sure.
on the European
sure.
press?
For example, well, I remember an article in L'Express, which is a French magazine, you know, comparable to, let's say, Newsweek here.
Mm-hmm.
And there were pictures, for example, after the bombing of a, you know, what the bombing was doing in Afghanistan. You did see some people that had been bombed. There was, I remember, a picture that was really a horrible picture to look at, a father crying over his five kids that were dead.
Mm.
Now, this is not the kind of pictures that we did see mm-hmm. back in the U.S. in October. Now there are some news that are coming that, yes, the bombing was not so surgical.
Right.
That's one typical example.
Yeah, and a dramatic one. Let's get Tom Rosenstiel's reaction. Tom Rosenstiel?
I think there's a couple of reasons for that. Well, first of all, most news institutions have a harder time covering things close to home, in the sense that the BBC, I understand, you know, does a much more skewed job covering, you know, the conflict in Northern Ireland than they do covering the American conflict in Afghanistan. That's not an excuse, but there are these cultural inhibitions. The other factors here are that the press is a very reactive, unfortunately, very reactive institution, and is cowed by public opinion to an extent that I think is sad. If the president is popular, and this one is, we are less likely to see coverage that is critical of the president.
Mm. In fact, if
there's no dissent mm-hmm. in Congress over mm-hmm. over war policy, there's going to be less dissent in our coverage. And
mm-hmm.
this is something that I wish was not always the case, but it is unfortunately a fact.
And you point out here to me the sort of salient finding of this study: coverage, criticism of any sort of the administration, of war policy, in these various media has been only at about 10%. 10% of what's written and said is critical.
Well, 10% of the stories, could be described as primarily critical.
That is the balance of the story.
Right.
Yeah.
And in most cases, the majority of stories have been almost entirely positive. So
mm-hmm.
even the stories that have even some mix of viewpoints have been generally less than 50%.
Yes.
Julie? Sort of a question for Tom, but in defense of analysis or punditry, it seems to me that there's an important role that the media has played, and maybe it's the difference between what's going on in Afghanistan and here in America, but certainly, let's say, I'm going to pick three out of a hat, you know, the issue regarding the executive order creating the military tribunals, how to classify the prisoners on Guantanamo Bay, whether they're unlawful combatants or prisoners of war, and then now this sort of over the weekend, certainly this question about what we're going to do next with Iraq, that mm-hmm. this very public debate that the media's print, all media is permitting analysts, commentators to comment about, I think, is important because these are hard issues that don't have a single yes-no answer.
Right.
Whether military tribunals are the best way to deal with these guys is up for grabs. But also, I think that they have assisted in maybe moving the government in ways that many would view as beneficial. So after the initial criticism of Bush's executive order on military tribunals, I think the public outcry through the media probably is what's leading the Bush administration to reconsider, certainly has led them to not put anyone before the military tribunals right now. So it seems like they're, for some of these are very contentious, not easily fact-based issues, there is an important role for that analysis. And I just don't know where that fit into your study, because you certainly covered these time periods. The military tribunal issue came, I think, out in late October.
Yeah. I mean, we're not, excuse me,
sure.
we're not advocating with these studies that all coverage needs to be factual. In fact, we're not really commenting in a sort of pro or con way mm-hmm. at all about the findings, as much as we're using them to try and describe the phenomena that we observe. Why is it that the coverage is less popular? Why is it that the coverage doesn't contain quite as much dissent or criticism as we might have expected? I think you're right that there is a crucial role for debate in our press coverage. I mean, basically, what journalism is and began as at the beginning of the Enlightenment was conversation between citizens that occurred in public houses and coffee houses. And that really, at essence, is what it still should be.
Mm-hmm.
It's important, I think, that public conversation be based on a foundation of fact. And I think this is where the debate mm-hmm. can go awry, is if we sort of leap to analysis and punditry when people don't even sort of understand the basic facts,
right.
and suddenly you're having an argument that is more inflaming than informing.
Sure, sure. Let's take another call. Laura is on the line. Hello.
Hi. That sort of relates to the point I was going to make, but if I could make two really quickly.
Sure.
One is that I would like people who opine to really know what they're talking about and to know. And I don't think that most people do. It's one thing if you're going to talk about the military prisons, if you know about the constitutional law behind it and you know the history of military prisons and such. And it's a different if it's just in accord with your political opinion. And I would like to relate it, if I might, to what I consider to be a sort of a glamour slash laziness factor among generally about the press. It's very difficult to do investigative reporting, and it strikes me as being rather not glamorous to really do the hard work. And I feel like, for example, the facts of Enron were probably out there a couple of years ago, maybe a year ago, I don't know. But it's very easy now to reconstruct it, and we depend on the press to maybe help us prevent some of these things by telling us stuff that's in the public domain already, like the SNL crisis. I think that the knowledge was out there. What was happening could have been seen if that hadn't been such a trudge work job to do. I could be wrong about this.
That's a very interesting contrast between sort of unballasted opinion on the one hand and, on the other hand, detailed, dug, investigative reporting. Tom Rosenthal?
I think it relates to the point that we were just talking about rather nicely. If the objective of your TV show or even your story is to get the two most polarized views on a subject, I think that may often lead you to people who are perhaps not necessarily experts in an academic setting, who have real jobs and are grounded in a natural community, where if they come off as too from one extreme or the other, in such a clear, and mm-hmm. dare I say, simple-minded way or mm-hmm. simple way, mm-hmm. that they'll lose credibility in the intellectual community in which they work. If you want to debate such things as should we go into Iraq? Is Iraq and Iran are these and North Korea equivalent in some kind of axis of evil? What is terrorism? What mm-hmm. is the definition of war? Some of these abstract debates that we were talking about, it's one kind of debate if you get genuine experts who see these things in nuanced ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's another kind of debate if you get, people who think yes and no.
Yeah.
And the you can sort of decide, what is this journalist, what is this program, what is this story, this reporter, what are they trying to do based on who they're having me listen to?
In fact, Judith's got a good story about that, about the sort of hunt for opinions on anything.
Yeah, well, yesterday I got a call from one of the 24-hour news stations, that narrows it down to three or four, that they wanted to do a story was a pretty fact-based story about this new government initiative to re-examine its hostage protocol. So if, for example, the Wall Street Journal reported, what should the government do? Seems like a good idea, not a huge drama there. And they had a prominent former Secretary of Defense on in support of it, and we're looking desperately for someone who would oppose it. And I was asked whether I could go on to oppose it, even though I personally think it's a good idea. And I said to the booker, and Laura, the caller, brings up a good point. I said to her, you know, why does this have to be a debate? Why can't you just say, you know, here's something the government's been thinking about. It seems like a good idea. But there has been this sort of urge. And Laura brings up a good point that is clear. When you look at these, a lot of these experts on, a lot of them are security specialists in the private industry who gain a lot from making all of us who watch them a little bit more nervous than maybe we should be, sort of drumming up business for a continuing threat going on there. Mm-hmm. And it's good to note sort of where these people are coming from, because none of them will be in business if, you know, terrorism goes away, or if it dissipates, or if we are know, viewed as secure.
Right.
There's incentives out there.
Yeah. And I think it's one of the scandals, really, of some of these news programs. And I would instance the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, that regularly they bring in people who are, in effect, lobbyists for opinions, who are paid to have their opinions, as opposed to disinterested analysts. And that just strikes me as just simply giving a propaganda field day. What do you think about that, Tom Rosenstein?
You know, this is what Michael Crichton has called the crossfire. Michael Crichton, the author of Fiction, has called the crossfireization of the press. And the irony with it is, while it makes for, you know, good television, supposedly, and that's what the bookers, if your listeners don't know, bookers are usually young people just getting into the news business, who are hired to have Rolodexes and find experts and guests, and they're instructed by their producers to, you know, build in conflict. We're looking for one of these and one of those. And they actually talk about casting the shows. That's the verb that's used. The irony with this cross-fireization, as Crichton has talked about it, is that most people, most citizens in the United States, and probably in any culture, don't reside at either of the polar extremes that are represented by the two guests. They're left out of the argument, you know, Lind, you know, death or life. And most people are thinking, well, I don't really know. And, you know, or abortion or gun control or any of these other issues that, you know, sort of dominate our politics. Most people are somewhere in the middle and do not see themselves in the debate that's going on a lot of the programs that they listen to that they watch.
Yeah, ambivalence is just not in on any of these shows. And one of the factors driving sort of concise opinions, Lynn dead, is time. You got 40 seconds. What can you say? You can hardly say, well, on the one hand, and on the other hand, you got to boil it down, and especially on television where the time imperatives are ruthless.
Speaking of, would never have made it on time.
No. Speaking of time imperatives, we have to stop for a bit. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
Boston University, this is...
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're grading the media's coverage of the war this hour, and we'd like your score. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dana is on the line. Hello.
Oh, good evening all to you, Jack, and your guests.
Good evening to you.
Thank you. I would like to cite two prominent examples of... the media coverage of this war in general, and these are two particular sycophantic examples who have shirked their duty as journalists, and that Dan Rather and Cokie Roberts.
Ah, give us Dan Rather.
All right, Dan Rather is quoted by a very good media watchdog group called FAIR as saying something to the effect of, to W, he said, give me a uniform tell me where, and I'll be there.
Mm.
That's not what a journalist is supposed to do. And Cokie Roberts is quoted from the same outlet, I guess she was on Letterman, as saying something to the effect of, I can't remember the exact quote, but she said to Letterman, I must confess, when I see those guys up there in their uniforms decked out with all their medals, I'm really impressed by them. I'm really, and they say something, and I'll believe them.
Hmm.
I mean, so much for the liberal media.
Well, yeah, and the mindless media. Isn't that the point, too, Tom Rosenstiel?
Yeah, you know, one of the things, the quote from Dan Rather comes from an appearance on, I think it was Letterman. I don't know the quote from, I don't know the source of the quote from Cokie Roberts, but it, you know, it does sound like, you know, when they're out of their news mode. And this is one of the artifacts or byproducts, perhaps, of the journalist as celebrity. Let's get Dan on Letterman because that has a younger audience. We want to boost we're skewing old on the CBS Evening News. Mm-hmm. Let's get Dan into that venue, and Dan there wants to loosen up and sort of be the personal side of Dan. I know Dan Rather, and that man on Letterman is no Dan Rather. You know, this is one of the weird things that goes on when we want to promote our news personalities and turn them into personalities. So, I see suddenly Katie Couric is analyzing the opening of the Olympics like it's the Thanksgiving Day parade.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really news, and she's not doing news. And what am I supposed to think of her? And her show is not really. I mean, this kind of cross-fertilization it makes me queasy.
And it makes the public queasy, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly confuses. Mm-hmm. It encourages a kind of confusion where, Cokie Roberts is reporting the news on NPR, but then she's commenting as a liberal commentator on This Week with Sam and Cokie. And which Cokie am I seeing at any given moment?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, since September 11th, just picking up on Tom's point, it has been remarkable just sitting on the sidelines here how many of these media personalities have been the subject of stories, salary debates, the massive changes. Geraldo Rivera at Fox, Greta Van Susteren at Fox, Larry King's big salary increase. I think both Katie Couric and Greta Van Susteren have graced the cover of People in the last 2 months, People magazine. So it's, you're getting this complete sort of idolization of these people who we should be looking to just sort of simply for the facts, as you say.
It was interesting, Jack. Howard K. Smith died over the weekend.
Yes.
His obituary was in this morning's papers. And
longtime CBS and then ABC news correspondent starting World War II.
Right. He was a Rhodes Scholar who Edward R. Murrow had hired to join CBS Radio during World War II, was one of the Murrow boys. He was fired at CBS because he decided to inject his opinions about civil rights into a special report that he did on civil rights for CBS, and William Paley thought that he had crossed over the line into editorializing. And Smith said that he felt that the treatment of blacks in the South was similar to, in its evil, to the Nazism that he'd covered as a young journalist in Germany, and that certain stories required you to step out. And it, as an act of conscience, he did this. He was fired, and then ABC hired him because they felt that his act of conscience made him a more valuable news person for their network.
Gave him credibility.
ABC was trying to build credibility.
Sure, sure.
Today, I mean, the notion that you would then attract publicity and get on the cover of People magazine because you had cosmetic surgery. I mean,
we've come a long way.
And not in the right direction.
Not in the right direction. Dana, thank you for that call. Bill is on the line from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm wondering if you'd speak to the issue of postmodernism, which, as I understand it, its thesis is, at least in part, that every opinion matters the same, And it really is almost the death of the expert in the sense that if I have a voice and I have a venue, I can speak my mind, and that opinion is held as having almost the same worth as someone who has studied perhaps a lifetime on that very subject. Do you see that as playing into the public debate on these issues?
Tom Rosenthal? Postmodernism?
I think we have seen, not because the bookers at CNN are self-conscious postmodernists, but we have seen a devaluation of the expert. I mean, there was a time when programs on television actually sought out experts. There was a time when they also sought out print people who had a lot of experience on beats to lend television credibility. We now see a kind of class of pseudo-experts, television experts, who gravitate from story to story. One of the refreshing, you know, they're for Gary Condit, they're for Monica Lewinsky, they're for Princess Diana. One of the refreshing things that we saw, I think, in the beginning of the coverage of the war on terrorism was that this was such a serious event. This was not something that was happening, you know, in 19 inches on television, that there was an abandonment of the pseudo-expert, at least for a while. And we needed to know people who actually knew something.
Yeah, yeah. Let's take a call. Joe is on the line.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Welcome.
I'm on a cell phone. I hope you can hear me. But I just wanted to bring something up. I'm an airline pilot.
Yeah.
And I'm also a retired Marine Corps pilot. So what's happening in the world today, I kind of have an expertise in. And you were bringing up some things about no longer going to the true experts, and that is so true. I'll give you some examples. Dr. Bob Arnott might be a very good doctor, but during the crash in Long Island of the American Airlines jet,
he's an ABC analyst. Is that his?
He's an analyst, right. He's a medical expert.
Okay, okay.
Yet
I just didn't know
he
was.
They were using him. I think they were in a panic mode. I don't know if they couldn't find a pilot, but they had him commenting about the air crash. I won't give you specifics, but just about everything he said was wrong. He brought up terms that no pilot I know, and I've got 30 years of flying, had ever heard of. Another example is these retired officers in the military who probably had noble careers, but who are probably justly retired. What people don't understand, and I've been listening to it, I'm a veteran of the Gulf in Vietnam, and what people don't understand is just because a man wears stars does not particularly mean that he was a tactically competent individual. And what's really hard is to watch these guys in their bad suits and ties talk about military operations. If a man's an aviator, he probably doesn't know a lot about ground combat operations. If he's an infantryman, he might not be very well versed. It's a rear officer who's well versed in all the different areas of combat. And yet we listen to him, and this isn't to disparage him because they've had good careers, I'm sure.
Sure.
But what I'm saying is we have to be very careful. Stars do not equate to tactical proficiency. And you just have to look around at some of the wars that we've lost, and these guys are commenting. And my joke on this is if they were so good, how come we lost the war in the Gulf?
Right.
How come we lost the war in Vietnam? In terms of tactical proficiency, they just weren't that good. Yet they're telling us how to fight this new war, which I find completely outrageous. So, yeah, we've lost the expert because we don't – just because a man is a pilot, just because a man is a military officer, we can't give him the weight that we do. We have to interview him. You have to find out, is he competent? Was he a competent officer? Does he know what he's talking about tactically? It's just it's quite aggravating to hear things you know about.
And to you, especially with your expertise. Tom Rosenthal, how about that, the military expert?
Yeah, you know, I think there's I think this touches on the earlier point, first of all, that the more you know, the more nuanced your views and the less suitable that make you for certain kinds of programming. And I think the other is this idea of a concept that's become very important in all of journalism, unfortunately, is the concept of branding.
Mm.
We want to brand our network to this story. Mm. That's what all the flag logos are about. It's also part of what this military expert, consultant is about. We, you know, he's, people like him, he's good, so we're going to go to him a lot and have him comment on every military tactical question because he's our brand name mm. on military tactics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who, this is branding consultants coming in and telling the journalists how to do their journalism. And it's the citizens are being cheated. One of the phenomenons mm. we have now in this information environment is that we have a lot of experts in the audience, people
yeah.
who know an enormous amount.
Joe, for example.
Right.
Yeah, who can look at this and say, hey, this guy's a doctor, and he's talking about aeronautics.
And he's using terms that don't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
This should be humiliating for us in the news business
mm.
to be talking down to an audience that knows more than we do.
Yeah.
And I think that this, maybe there's some lessons to be learned from this, certainly after September 11th, but I would say even better would probably be the anthrax example with sort of the nightmare scenario where you had all these government officials coming out is for local and state officials who will likely have to deal with, say, the next terrorism crisis, it probably behooves them now to start thinking about, do they have a series of people that they trust that mm. they can make available to the press? Because as Tom certainly knows, I think a lot of these agencies are incredibly lazy. And so they get a name and they just keep calling that name. And if they're available, and if we can get some of our, for example, during the anthrax scare, like some very knowledgeable public health officials who would be people who could talk about it, who were made available to the press. I don't know if that would work from the press's perspective because maybe they're not the most interesting people, maybe, but mm. certainly I'd rather hear about anthrax and how I get it from, you know, the public health official in Trenton than from some. Than from me, you know.
And that was partly the government's fault, too.
Yeah.
They had Tommy Thompson.
They had
out there trying to wing it, really.
Right. They had
anthrax.
They were unwilling to say what they didn't know. And then they it wasn't. I mean, the problem was there was no singular voice. So you had Tommy Thompson, John Ashcroft, Tom Ridge, all of them trying to get a handle on a story that was really a sort of science story
yeah.
That none of them had expertise in.
Sure. Tom Rosenthal, just in closing, the press has become more critical now. We're reading about civilian casualties, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Do you expect we're going to hear more that 10% criticism is going to go up a little bit more?
We had the United States had extraordinary success in the war in Afghanistan, and overall, and so the coverage reflected that. And this war is going to slow down, take longer. We have not caught Bin Laden. Where do we go next? We're unlikely to sustain the kind of success in such a clear way. And the press abhors a vacuum and abhors an absence of facts. It's going to fill the void with speculation about, you know, why have we not succeeded?
And
there's an old saying that the media eat their young. And, you know, we've built this effort up, and the worm will turn in probably as much exaggerated a way as the coverage was slanted in a positive direction in the beginning.
Tom Rosenthal, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Tom Rosenthal is director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, a research institute affiliated with Columbia. He's the co-author of The Elements of Journalism, What News People Should Know and the Public Should Expect. And Judit Kayyem, thank you. Judit Kayyem is the executive director of the Executive Session on Domestic Preparedness at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. What grade would you give the media? Do stories reveal more of what journalists think, not what they know? To view the Project for Excellence in Journalism's study of the media's performance during the war, check out our website. The address is onpointradio.org. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're